Maggie stared at the medic. Where did all that come from, Mac?
My grandfather left me a complete collection of the whole Earth catalog, a load of 60s and 70s counterculture stuff. I got quite interested in it, you know. Some of their values were laudable. But when it comes to the meat and potatoes, the secret to building a home in a place like this isn't about ideals and theory, and not about getting high. It's about hard work, alongside a sense of humor, and the goodwill of your neighbors, and putting your back into the future. But what you've got down there, I think, is the seed of tragedy. Along with Margarita Hia from biology, I analyze that lovely little flower that grows everywhere in their woods, addictive and hallucinogenic, like there's no tomorrow, growing like a weed.
But Mac, ye gods, are we going to have to send a drug enforcement agency unit to every settlement? They have to work it out for themselves.
That's how it got resolved on the datum in the end. After step day, there was an explosion in the drug trade. With stepping pushers, there was no way to police it. In the inner cities, the cops pulled back and, well, let's say they let natural selection take its course. She looked at him as he said these words, his tone neutral. In the course of his career, Mac had evidently seen a lot of stuff even she, in the military, had been shielded from. She said,
Well, we're done with this particular can of worms. I think they'll let this guy Hartman out. But it's been a salutary shock. They'll figure out ways to order their affairs better.
Sure. A neat wrap-up, said Mac sourly. But the frightening part of it is that we barely started this mission. What's waiting for us in the world next door?
Chapter 16 6 days out of Valhalla, somewhere around the Earth million mark, the gold dust made a stop at a clearing cut into yet another raw world's continent-sized forest. From the air, the Valientes saw it as a neat little rectangular patch, etched out of the green, an oddly touching island of humanity, all but lost in this global forest. But when you looked more closely, you could see that it wasn't humans who'd created the clearing, but a party of trolls, under the direction of a human, laboring even as the passengers looked down on them, those massive muscles working under their black pelts. Bosun Higgs had proved to be a bright kid, and surprisingly knowledgeable about the Long Earth, and the importance of the trolls. The big humanoids were ubiquitous, though not necessarily in large numbers, and they shaped the country they moved through, just on account of what they ate, pushed through, moved aside. In their ecological role, they were like the big animals of Africa, maybe, like elephants or wildebeest. As a result, Helen learned now, the landscapes of the stepwise worlds, while quite unlike the datum, were not quite like the datum as it had once been before humanity either, not for a long time, because as mankind had risen up, the trolls had fled. Well, the working trolls below looked content enough, but their overseer carried a whip, as Sally quickly pointed out. Joshua suggested he only used it to make a noise to attract the trolls' attention.
Yeah, right, said Sally.
Helen knew it was hard to tell how happy a troll was. You did hear of distressing incidents, such as the notorious case of the troll called Mary at the Gap, the case everyone was talking about, even the snobs aboard the Gold Dust. But you saw trolls wherever people were, working like this. They seemed to enjoy it. Of course, if you pushed them too hard, they could simply step away. Maybe they were just too useful to have a conscience about. Disturbing thought. And, as Sally said to Joshua, you wondered what they thought about humans. The party dropped off supplies for the logging team and brought up samples of exotic lichen in little plastic packs, lichen taken from very old trees. Old trees were rare on Datum Earth, and were becoming so even on the heavily logged Low Earths. That was the nature of the trade across the Long Mississippi, as Helen had learned the pilots called this stepwise route. Raw materials flowed in towards the Datum, timber, foodstuffs, minerals, but bulk goods mostly came from the Corn Belt worlds further in, and only rare or precious items were worth bringing in from beyond the half-million step mark. such as unique old tree lichens and other exotic flora and fauna. Indeed, Joshua suggested, as they watched this trade proceed, their own community ought to think about exporting hell knows where maple liquor. In exchange, the datum shipped out low-mass but high-tech goods, from medical kit to electrical generators to coils of fiber-optic cable, so the colonists could establish decent communication networks in their new worlds. It was the kind of trade that had always characterized the settlement of new territories, such as between Britain and its American colonies before the Revolution, with high-quality manufactured products being sent out from the homeland in return for raw materials. Helen's father and his footprint Congress buddies would probably claim it was exploitative. Maybe. But it seemed to Helen to work. And besides, whoever was ripping off whom, it had to be a good thing for this great river of airships to be linking all the worlds of mankind together. So Helen thought, anyhow. 12 days out from Valhalla, and they crossed a diffuse boundary into the Corn Belt, the great band of farming worlds 1/3 of a million steps thick, stretching in towards the datum from about 460,000 worlds out. The skies were a lot busier now, with trains like their own heading towards the datum, passing those heading back out, upstream, so to speak. The gold dust had made pretty fast progress to this point, but from now on the stops would be more frequent. There were way stations spread out stepwise all along the long Mississippi, and further down the river geographically too, in many of these worlds. Helen was told that, as they approached the datum, these stations would show up more frequently. At the way stations, the train stopped to take on cargo loads gathered here from the nearby worlds for collection. Sacks of corn were the staple export from these particular earths, and the crews, with plenty of troll labor, worked in chains to get the train's gaping holds loaded up. The stations had inns and the like, for rest and recreation. These weren't polite places, Helen observed. Many of them had a calaboose, a little jailhouse. One way station they stopped at, however, was in a world that happened to be a little warmer than the rest, and the owners had taken the opportunity to establish sprawling sugar plantations and orange groves and palmettos, rare this far north in any America. The sugar house where they processed their cane was a huge clanking factory. The owner's house was like a colonial mansion, constructed of the local timber, with verandas and carved pillars draped with magnolias. And the captain, the Valiente family, and a few other guests were invited down to drink orange liqueur. In the fields you could see the bent backs of the troll workers, and their song floated on the hot breeze. The real tourist spectacle in the Corn Belt was the timber trade. Rafts of the stuff from the forests to the north were floated downstream on one Mississippi or another. At a way station, the rafts would be lifted out of the water by a twain or two, and then ganged together by trolls and human workers. The end result was one tremendous platform that might be an acre in size, suspended in the air, constructed of long straight trunks, stripped and roped together, each held up by a squadron of airships. And off the twains would go, stepping across the worlds with their vast, dangling freight, with parties of trolls and their human supervisors riding in huts and tents on the timber platforms. Just an astounding sight. What was even more remarkable was what they saw going the other way. One of the principal exports of the Low Earth to the outer worlds was horses. So you'd see a twain descend, and the great ramps from the hold fold down, and out would trot a herd of young horses, supervised by cowboys on horseback. Occasionally, they passed over relics of what used to be an old trekking trail, like the one Helen's family followed to get out to reboot on Earth West 101,754. Information flags or warning posts, abandoned halfway houses. Thanks to the twains, the days of pioneer trekking, of foot slogging across 100,000 worlds, were gone. A phase of history that had only lasted a few years, but was already passing into legend. Helen wondered what the likes of Captain Batson, who had led her particular trek, were doing now. Yet the trails were still in use, by gangs of humans driving troll bands one direction or the other across the long earth. Helen could never tell if the trolls were singing or not. These sights were mostly just glimpses, gone in a second or two, as they travelled on.
Chapter 17. 10 years after the epic journey of Joshua Valiente and Lobsang, Twain technology, offered as open source by the Black Corporation, had become the standard way of moving groups of people and large cargoes around the long Earth. But Jacques Montcuq reflected gleefully as he prepared for his mission into deep stepwise China, some Twain journeys were more spectacular than others. This particular journey with Roberta Golding was to begin from Datum, China. Once the rather lengthy preliminaries were complete, the sister ships, Zheng He and Liu Yang, lifted into the dome of smog that hung over Jiangcheng, Henan province. Standing in the Zheng He gondola's main observation lounge, Jacques was able to look up through the window to see the ship's great silvery hull overhead, the skin flexing like the hide of some muscular animal as the Twain began, literally, to swim through the air. The ship's mobile hull would have been a remarkable sight, even if it hadn't been adorned with the clasped hand symbol of the 8-year-old Federated Republic of China. They soon left the airfield behind and drifted over factories and car parks and rubbish tips of a grimy industrial zone. Roberta Golding, Jacques' charge, 15 years old, stood by the big floor-to-ceiling windows, impassively inspecting the landscape drifting below. And a dozen trolls, here in the observation lounge, began to sing Slow Boat to China, the song strung out into a round and layered with harmony, like honey piled on a piece of toast, in the trolls' usual fashion. Around Jacques, a scattered handful of crew, along with a few more informally dressed types who looked like scientists, glanced out of the windows and laughed at jokes Jacques couldn't catch and couldn't have translated if he had. Jacques and Roberta, from Happy Landings, were used to having trolls around. But some of the crew stared at the trolls as if they were an utterly unfamiliar sight. Jacques noticed one crewman, close to the big animals, wearing a conspicuous weapon of some kind at his hip, as if they might be about to go on the rampage. A uniformed young Chinese, a woman, evidently a crew member, offered Jacques and Roberta drinks, fruit juice, water. Jacques took a water and sipped it. "Thanks."
"It is my pleasure."
"Nice choice of song."
"We thought it was an amusing choice to welcome you," she said brightly. "We being the crew, for this is a fast boat from China, you see."
She proffered a hand for a strong shake. Dark-haired, sensible-looking, rather than attractive, she might have been 25 years old.
"I am Lieutenant Wu Yuesai, a Federal Army officer, but attached to the Chinese National Space Administration."
"Ah, which is running this East 20 million project?"
"Exactly. You can see the logic. Our space engineers are trained to handle advanced technology in unfamiliar and extreme environments. Who better to confront the mysteries of the Far East worlds? I, however, trained as a pilot. I have ambitions to become an astronaut someday. For now, I have been assigned an informal role as companion to your protege, Miss Roberta Golding, if that is acceptable to you, and indeed to Miss Golding. You will call me Yuesai, I hope."
"And she'll want you to call her Roberta, I'm sure."
"Perhaps she has informal names, Robbie, Bobby."
Jacques glanced at Roberta, who was solemnly sipping her orange juice.
"Roberta," he said firmly,
"what do you mean? What kind of companion?"
"I am relatively close to her in age. Of course, I am the same sex. I have enjoyed a broad education in philosophy and the humanities, as well as science and engineering, just as Ms. as Roberta has."
"Well, Roberta's basically self-taught."
"My primary duty is to ensure her safety whenever we leave the ship, during ground excursions and so forth. No doubt we will encounter many hazardous incidents."
"That's a thoughtful gesture."
"It is my honor. I have been studying English especially, as have many of the crew, including the captain.
I can tell. Thank you. We'll make a good team.
I'm sure we will.
Captain Chen Zhong approached now, bustling across the carpeted floor of the deck. As he passed, his crew subtly straightened up, and their faces became more solemn. Chen shook the hands of Jacques and Roberta. He brandished some kind of control box in his left hand.
In a moment, we'll be off. Of course, we are already in the air, but soon we will be swimming stepwise, too.
His accent was stronger than Wu's, but more complex, some of his phrasing almost British. Aged around 50, he was short, a little stout for a military man, Jacques thought, but sleek, supremely confident. Jacques would have been prepared to bet he was a survivor of the fallen communist regime.
So glad you could come with us, that all the various formalities were overcome. A tricky process, given the newness of our nation. Of course, the welfare of Miss Golding is a top priority.
Now he faced Roberta.
I hope you'll have time to enjoy the experience. Such a pretty thing. Forgive me for saying it. Yet you are so serious.
Roberta, taller than he was, just looked back at him. Chen winked at Jacques.
Quiet one, is she? But observant. No doubt you're drinking in the details of the airships even as they are launched. The unusual mode of propulsion, for instance.
To Jacques' relief, Roberta deigned to reply to this.
The flexible hull, you mean? Strung with some kind of artificial muscle, contracting when electrical impulses are applied?
Very good. Very good. With the electricity provided by solar power, you can see why such a system is appropriate. When we observe the worlds we explore, why not do it with as little noise and other disturbance as possible? We hope to reach Earth East 20 million, our nominal target, nearly 10 times further than any human has ventured into the long Earth before, in a mere few weeks. We estimate we will also need to maintain a velocity, that is a lateral velocity, of over 100 miles per hour in the process. I'm sure you can see why.
Roberta shrugged.
That's trivial.
Jacques exchanged a glance with Yuesai. That was one of Roberta's more annoying verbal tics. The need for a sideways speed might be obvious to her, but wasn't at all obvious to Jacques, or it seemed to Yuesai. The point went unexplained. Chen said,
You know your engineering, then, but what of your wider education? Are you aware of the provenance of the names of our pioneering ships?
Liu Yang was the first Chinese woman in space, and Zheng He was the eunuch admiral who...
Yes, yes, I can see we have little to teach you.
He smiled.
Then let us explore together.
He held up the gadget in his left hand. It was like a television remote, Jacques thought, and on it was a familiar corporate logo, a black corporation mark.
Chen said, I hope you have all been following your nausea inoculation regimes. Now, are you ready? Every journey must begin with a single step.
He pressed a button. Jacques felt a familiar jolt to the gut, but faint, a ghost sensation. The crowded landscape of Datum Henan was whisked away. Suddenly rain clattered on the windows and bounced off the great hull overhead. The trolls, apparently unperturbed, sang on. Chen led the party to the big, downward-looking windows at the gondola's prow, so they could see better. At first glance, Jacques could see little difference in the landscape below, Henan East 1 compared with the original. More, cruder factories, and coal-burning power stations belching smoke, roads like muddy tracks. A smoggy tinge to the air. Yet in the distance, there were patches of green, of forest, and that wasn't like the original.
Chen said, Henan, long ago the cradle of Han civilization, you know, but in more recent times, something of a hellhole, exploited, over-industrialized. 100 million people crammed into an area the size of the state of Massachusetts.
That was a Datum Earth reference that meant little to Jacques, but he got the idea.
Datum Henam was once a prime source of migrants to cities like Shanghai, who became the cleaners and the clerks and the barkeeps and the prostitutes. You can imagine that on step day a rather large proportion of the population of such places as this wandered over into the new worlds with alacrity. It took the authorities some time to restore order. You should not underestimate the impact that stepping had on the Chinese people as a whole in those early days. And not just the economic or other practical effects. I mean rather the psychological, as you will see. Of course you know that the disruptions after step day eventually led to the, retirement of the last communist regime.
He studied Roberta, evidently curious about her reaction.
So we begin our exploration, Miss Golding. Here we are on Earth East 1 of 20 million. What do you understand the purposes of this expedition to be?
She thought before answering.
To see what's out there.
He seemed pleased by the simplicity of the reply.
Yes, we will count the worlds, and we will catalogue them, number them. We will establish the longitude of the long Earth East, so to speak. I have seen your academic record. Your intellect is evidently remarkable. You don't think a mere voyage of exploration, of fact-gathering, is trivial? We are like butterfly collectors, are we not?
She shrugged. If you want to understand butterflies, you first have to collect butterflies. Or finches. Chen seemed to puzzle over that word.
Ah, like Darwin on Galapagos. A neat reference. Well, I can't promise you finches, but butterflies?
He let that tail off mysteriously. Why did you bring the trolls? He glanced at her sharply.
Good question. I should have known you would ask it. In the planning, most people dismissed our trolls as, what, as a cabaret, an animal show. Not you. The trolls, in a sense, are the long earth, are they not? Their long call stitches it together, and, I believe, appeals to the musical sensibilities of all Chinese people. Now we may be venturing further than even any troll has travelled before. Think of that. And we want whatever we discover in those remote footprints of China to become part of the troll song.
Jacques said, of course you know that trolls are an integral part of our lives in the community we come from.
Ah, yes, so I hear, although you keep its location secret, don't you?
We treasure our privacy.
Of course you do.
Chen pressed his button, and they stepped once again. Jacques noticed a counter on the wall, flickering digits that would count the worlds. In East 2, the sky was bright, the sun high, and the land was carpeted with green, with forest. The contrast with the datum, and even East 1, the sudden flood of colour, the light illuminating the observation deck, was breathtaking.
Chen said, you can see why a sudden access to all this so startled people. Our nation is older than yours, older than Europe. China has been cultivated, built on, fought over, mined for 5,000 years. It was a shock for us to walk into this primordial green. There were immediate cultural responses, an upsurge in support for environmental protection, songs, poems, paintings, most of them bad. Ha! Well, there was nothing much we could do about East 1 or West 1. Quickly ruined by the first flood of travellers, the first helpless and hapless migrants, each footprint became one big shantytown. But the government organized quickly, and we kept East 2 as a kind of national park, a memorial of Step Day, of our sudden access to our country's own past, as best we could anyhow. Even here we are harmed by pollution from the heavy industrialization of this low earth in such places as the United States footprint, and there are ongoing negotiations in the United Nations about that. We also store some of our treasures here, the heritage of our deep culture. Even a few buildings, temples dismantled and rebuilt. Just as humanity is preserved from extinction by the existence of the long earth, should any calamity befall our home world, so now is our cultural past.
Roberta pressed her forehead against the window, gawping, briefly looking like any curious teenager.
I see animals, moving through the forest. Elephants? Heading towards that river over there to the north.
Chen smiled.
Elephants, which roam as far north as Beijing, in some worlds, and camels, bears, lions, tigers, black swans, even river dolphins, tapirs, deer, pangolins. On step day, our children choked in the smog-free air, were frightened by the brightness of the sun, and goggled at the animals.
The captain pressed his control button again. In East 3, the forest had been cleared, and the river dammed, to flood the ground. In the resulting paddy fields, people labored, bent over, not looking up as the shadows of the airships passed. It was the same in East 4, 5, 6, and beyond, though the methods of farming differed. In some worlds, there was industrialization, with smoke rising from distant power stations and foundries, and crude-looking machines rolling across vast fields. In others, just the people and their animals.
Very organized, Jacques said. Oh, yes, Yuisai said brightly. We Chinese were able to move into the stepwise worlds in a disciplined and industrious way, matched, I would suggest, nowhere else in the world. Under the communists, we were a one-party state, equipped with the tools of late capitalism, capable of very large-scale feats. In recent decades, we had already had experience of massive projects on the datum, infrastructure like dams and bridges and rail lines, even a space program. Now, the Long Earth offered a blank canvas. Since the regime change, despite a revision of ideology, we have lost none of those skills. That's China for you.
Roberta said,
Could we pause here?
Of course.
Chen pressed his buttons. Jacques looked down. The airship was hovering over a waterlogged field, where a peasant stood patiently, holding a piece of rope tied around the neck of what looked like a buffalo.
That's a scene that could be 2,000 years old, he said.
Roberta said, Captain Chen, in some of these agricultural worlds there are factories producing artificial nutrients.
Also genetically engineered crops, modern farming machinery.
Yet here, you are evidently manuring the soil. It seems a contradiction.
Yuisai said,
We use both ways. This is an expression of an old tension in Chinese philosophy.
The Tao versus Confucianism, Roberta said. Chen looked impressed. Yuisai nodded.
Essentially correct. The Tao is the way. To follow the way means a harmonization with nature. The Confucians, by contrast, argue that man must master nature for the betterment of nature as well as the benefit of mankind. Wars have been fought over these ideas. The Confucians won in the 2nd century BC, but now we have room to spread out, to explore other ways.
Dao Zai Jin Yao, Roberta said. Chen laughed out loud.
The way is in the piss and the shit. Very good, very good.
Roberta seemed neither pleased nor offended by his praise. The airship moved on. Around East 20, a belt of more industrialized worlds began. Jacques looked down on factories, power stations, mineheads, industrial parks cut into the green. Lines of workers moved between workshops and shabby-looking dormitory, refectory and shower blocks. Cargo airships hovered or were tethered to masts. On many of these worlds, smoke and soot and smog hung thick in the air. Chen was observing their reactions.
Few Westerners have seen this, save for those who have put money into these third front developments. Douglas Black, for one.
Jacques asked, Why third front?
Ah, that's a reference to Mao, Chen said, and winked again. In response to aggression from the Soviets in the 1960s, Mao scattered industrial production facilities across China, into the remote west, for example, so that it became more difficult to cripple us with nuclear bombs, you see. He encouraged workers to go out there. The further from father and mother,
the nearer to Chairman Mao's heart. That was the slogan. As then, so now. One can despise Mao's crimes while admiring his ambition.
Jack wondered if you could have one without the other. He said, "You can't seriously be suggesting there's a risk of some kind of shooting war with the West."
"There are other threats. Stepping itself has destabilized nations, including China, of course, and climate collapse on the datum with all that would follow could yet be a serious issue."
They came to a world, East 38 according to the wall counter, where a thunderstorm was raging. The two airships drifted in a sky populated by huge, lumpy, rushing grey clouds, and rain lashed down on the forest below. Jack observed what looked like the scars of lightning strikes, blackened craters in the forest cover. Chen watched them expectantly.
"I don't understand," Jack said. "What is it we are meant to see here?"
"You could only perceive it properly from orbit, perhaps," Chen said. "Here, soldier engineers are using atomic weapons to blast paths and tunnels through the Himalayas, thus removing an accident of geology that disrupted the flow of air and moisture across Eurasia. In this world, the interior of Asia will be green."
Jacques was astonished. "You're reshaping a whole mountain range?"
"Why not? And in another neighboring world, we are diverting all the rivers arising in the Himalayas, save for the Yangtze, again to bring moisture to the heart of the continent."
Roberta said, "More dreams of the Maoists."
"Yes, you know your history. Schemes that were too expensive or too risky to be tried out when the datum was all we had. Now we can experiment with no harm done. What dreams we have, what ambition. Aren't we Chinese great?"
Maybe, but Jacques wondered what the experience of these new worlds, these diverse environments, was doing to the souls of the colonists here. In the West worlds, different Americas were evolving, sharing their parents' values maybe, but subtly diverging. Here too that must be true, with new kinds of China developing, still rooted in the same deep history. Surely the Chinese would always stay Chinese, but each acquiring a whole new character. And he wondered how soon it would be before those new Chinas became restless, in search of freedom from their gigantic parent, like the Valhallan Belt Americas. As the lightning cracked in the sky, the trolls were growing anxious, their song fragmented. Chen lifted his remote control, apparently with regret.
"I would love to show you our new mountains, but we cannot linger. It is unsafe here."
Jacques asked, "Why the lightning?"
"No, no. The fallout from the atomic mining. On we go. Now we will speed up. You understand these ships are an experimental sort, developed by our own engineering companies in conjunction with the Black Corporation. One purpose of this exploration is to test the new technologies."
The passing of the worlds accelerated until, as Jacques could tell from his own pulse, the realities were washing past at the rate of roughly one a second. Blink. Blink, blink, then faster still. Most of the worlds were unremarkable, blankets of green under sunshine or cloud. But in some glaciated worlds, the sunlight glared from ice sheets, safely far beneath the prows of the twains. They were shown to a kind of lounge area. A steward circulated with food, soft drinks, China tea, and they sat chatting while whole worlds flapped by, unremarked. Jacques suspected Roberta would rather have been alone, studying, reading, making her own observations, but she sat politely enough, if mostly silently. After an hour or so, the airship paused, the light subtly different. When Jacques looked up, he saw butterflies, a tremendous swarm of them all around the ship, battering silently at the windows of the observation deck. Most were small, plain, but some were more colourful, and some had wings the size of saucers. The sunlight shone bright through their pale substance. Chen laughed at their reaction.
"A butterfly world! What the Westerners call a joker. Of course, an ecology needs more components than just butterflies. Nevertheless, here in this part of China, butterflies are all that come to greet us. We have no idea how this came about, what is different here.
Yet here we are. You see, Roberto Golding, I told you we would be counting butterflies. What do you think?
At length, Lieutenant Wu Yuesai said, It would certainly be hard to demonstrate chaos theory here. They were all silent as they worked that out. Then Jack was the first to laugh. Roberta, however, merely looked puzzled. Chapter 18 The crew of the Benjamin Franklin did take seriously their mandate to project the authority of the U.S. Datum government across the long Earth. It wasn't all about saving kittens stuck up trees, as Maggie told her crew. Which was why the twain made an unannounced stop at a town called Reboot, Earth West 101,754, in a stepwise New York State. A small group, led by Executive Officer Nathan Boss, a rare jaunt for him away from his desk, were landed from the twain in a kind of clearing of trampled-down mud beside a spidery trail that ran up from the coast of the local copy of the Atlantic. Nathan had seen the layout for himself clearly from the air, aboard the Franklin. The town itself was out of sight, but a short walk away, cut into the green of the crowding forest. Neat little fields and houses with smoke rising up, all connected by wide dirt tracks. This was one of the first of what Captain Kaufman was calling their hearts and minds assignments. They would turn up unannounced at a community on some world like this, in order to make themselves and their mission known, and, well, to gently remind these colonial Americans that they were still Americans. This early in the mission, they were still finding their way. So was Nathan Boss, his first time in charge of a ground team. And in this case, the logistics were surprisingly complicated. This town and its stepwise neighbors were linked in a kind of extended long Earth county, so the Franklin was hopping between the worlds, visiting one community after another, dropping equipment and setting down groups of sailors and marines at each of those neighbors. There were lots of ways such an operation could go wrong, as Nathan was all too well aware. Add to that the fact that the worlds of the Long Earth were themselves somewhat bewildering for the Twain's mostly Datum-born crew. As the Navy guys waited for the Marines to follow them off the Franklin, reflexively they spread out to form a perimeter. Though there was no visible threat here in Earth West 101,754. They looked around, evidently kind of baffled. Most of them were from urban backgrounds. Well, there was no urban background here. Nothing but the muddy clearing. Nobody around but a deer, well, Nathan thought it was a deer, that peered at them from out of a clump of forest. Nothing to read but a sign, homemade, hand-lettered. Welcome to Reboot, founded 2026 AD, POP 1465. Ensign Toby Fox, the IT nerd type from engineering, who had been tasked with making a census of the Long Earth, dutifully wrote down the population number. There was no sign of sun under a clouded-over sky, but the warmth was intense for an early May day, and Nathan was immediately sweating in his combat fatigues with his pack on his back. It was when Lieutenant Sam Allen came down from the twain, the last to land, and the Benjamin Franklin popped away stepwise with a soft implosion of air, that the real trouble started. Allen was in charge of a small chalk of Marines attached to this expedition. As his own guys stood around, evidently feeling a little lost in this latest new world, just like the sailors, Allen started badgering specialist Jennifer Wang.
So where's our equipment?
Wang already had her own pack off her back and was working her radio and locator gear.
Lieutenant, our gear was supposed to be landed within a half mile, not on top of us.
I know that. Which way, specialist?
Nathan knew that the equipment drop, a bunch of trunks in rope nets, had radio beacons to alert the arriving troops of its location, but Wang looked confused. She worked touch screens and even twisted dials on a very old-fashioned-looking radio receiver. All she picked up was squawking music, a clatter of guitars. Midshipman Jason Santorini, listening in, grinned.
Chuck Berry, my dad's favorite. Mint stuff. Even if it is like 100 years old or something. That's just some dumb local station,
growled Alan. Some kid in his barn. Turn it off. Wang complied.
Ensign Toby Fox was a small guy and more nervous than the rest. Now, before Nathan had a chance to get hold of the situation, Fox was the one who was unwise enough to ask Alan,
"So, Lieutenant, where is our stuff?"
Alan turned on him. "In the wrong fucking place, isn't it obvious?"
"Actually, it's probably in the wrong, fucking world, Lieutenant," Wang put in. "Or I'd be picking up its bleep by now."
By checking rosters, they soon figured it out. The drop had been made at another town, New Scarsdale, the county seat. Wang said,
"There's your error, sir. Scarsdale is over on 101,752.
Alan said,
"Where is this dump?"
Fox checked his mil-spec earth counter.
Right now, we're on 101,754, sir. Where we were supposed to be.
Somebody had miscounted the stepwise worlds. Nathan suspected miscommunication between the two command lines, the Navy crew and the Marines, datum-born, datum-trained crew, who weren't used to thinking in terms of planning for operating across different stepwise worlds in the first place. It happened.
"What a screw-up," Alan raged. "And those damn Navy boys stepped on without checking they got the rendezvous right."
Everybody else just stood around, too nervous to be the one to reply. Somewhere something growled, a huge bear maybe, a deep rumble like an earth tremor, and they gathered closer together.
"Okay, okay," Alan said. "We need to send a runner. Get that ship back here, and bring us to the gear, or the gear to us."
He poked a finger at random.
"You, McGivern, get your stepper out and get moving."
Sorry, Lieutenant, said the man. "No can do. I left behind my stepper."
"You did what? Okay, who the hell else is here in Earth 100,000 and shit, without the most elementary and obvious piece of kit of all, a stepper to get him home again?"
They all looked at each other. It was an obvious omission, Nathan thought. They were putting on a show of force here. They had come down lightly armed, but wearing flak vests, load-bearing harnesses, and packs with general gear and ammo, and whatever specialist stuff they had to carry. Anyone with any experience knew the score. From the K-pot on your head to the combat boots on your feet, it was a heavy load, and you left behind whatever you didn't specifically need for the mission. They were only supposed to have been down here, in this small town, in this one peaceful world, for a couple of hours. Why carry a stepper box, which, built to military specification, was a heavy, robust piece of kit? Turned out none of them had a stepper. Not Nathan, not even the lieutenant. And nobody dared grin at that. Nathan hadn't the nerve to meet Alan's eyes. Then one of the guys asked his buddy if he had some water to spare, because he was getting thirsty in the heat. But the other guy didn't. Turned out none of them had brought water, either, because that was all supposed to be in the drop. Not even Nathan. Not even the lieutenant. There was a stream not far away. You could hear it running. But these were all datum-born types who had had drummed into them from childhood that you didn't drink the local water. Not without an iodine tablet in it, at least. And none of them had even that. Not even Nathan. Not even the lieutenant. Alan prowled around, his fists clenched, looking as if he needed somebody to punch.
"All right, then. All right. So, we go to this dump reboot and start from there. Agreed, Commander Bosk?"
Nathan nodded. "Which way, Wang?" But there was no GPS on this world, no airship hovering to give them orientation, and even their paper maps were, predictably, in the airdrop. Surrounded by trees like cathedral spires, they couldn't see the rising smoke from the township. They couldn't even get a direction from the sun, given the cloudy sky. The fuck-up just got fucked upper with every second. Then a man came strolling into the clearing, whistling, rods in his hand, and some kind of big fish on a line he had thrown over his shoulder. He might have been 50, Nathan thought, with a deep-tanned face and a live toughness about him when he walked. When he found a dozen armed warriors glaring at him, he briefly froze. but then his face broke into a broad grin.
"Hey, soldiers," he said. "Did I break an ordinance? I'll throw it back, I promise."
Lieutenant Allen glared at the civilian. Then he turned to Wang.
"Ask him if he knows the way to this reboot place."
"Sir, do you know the way to reboot?"
"My name's Bill Lovell, by the way," he said heavily.
He looked around at them. Nathan felt profoundly embarrassed and somewhat overdressed.
"Don't tell me you're lost."
Allen didn't respond. Nathan tried to explain. Lovell shook his head as he listened.
"How the hell did your pilots manage to make a drop in the wrong world?"
Nathan said ruefully, "We're kind of learning our way around here, sir." Lovell was still grinning.
"I can see that. You folks just don't get the Long Earth way of thinking, do you? Here you are, lost as babies, and you're really planning to go all the way up to Valhalla?"
Wang asked, "You know about our mission?"
"Oh, news travels fast out here. That might surprise you, not me. I used to be a postman. I mean, for the U.S. Postal Service, before they cut out the service to the far stepwise worlds. Yeah, we heard about you."
Annan looked as if he longed to pistol whip this guy.
"You gonna show us the reboot or not?"
Lovell mock bowed.
"Follow me."
Nathan wasn't sure what he'd been expecting of reboot. A Dodge City movie set? Some kind of cluttered steampunk nirvana? A few primitive farms hacked out of the wilderness? Banjo players? In fact, as you could clearly see as you walked down the main drag from the river, it was a town. An American town, judging by the big stars and stripes hanging over the schoolhouse. Bill Lovell pointed out the sights.
"That's the old Wells place. One of the original plots."
A woman worked a garden behind a neat whitewashed fence, a real Acacia Avenue kind of scene. She looked up, smiled.
"Not that it looked like that when the first trackers got here in 26.
Toby Fox asked.
"As recently as that, just 14 years ago.
There's Arthurson's General Store, the only store in town right now, though a few of the farmhouses will sell you beer or liquor, or make you a meal, or hire you a room."
Santorini asked,
"Will they accept dollars?"
Lovell just laughed. There were horses and camels tied up at the rail outside the store. Laughter sounded from within. Then a bunch of children burst out of one of the houses and ran across the street. They might have been Native American kids to Nathan's urban eye, with hand-sewn leather trousers and jackets, and some kind of moccasins on their feet.
"School's out," Bill said.
He cupped a hand behind a fat ear.
"And can you hear that?"
When the kids had dispersed and their chatter subsided, Nathan heard a distant clank, clank, clank.
"The new sawmill, or rather the old sawmill with its new steam engine. Everything made locally, or at least every iron part. They promised themselves a water turbine power supply soon. They're even trialing a telegraph system to keep in touch with some of the outlying farms, which are pretty remote. Geographically, I mean."
He sounded as if he was proud of the citizens of Reboot, Nathan thought. Fatherly.
"Lots of little kids," Wang observed.
"Well, you have population booms going on across many of the settled Earths. In a few centuries, you might have hundreds of Earths teeming with billion-fold populations. Think of it. All those little taxpayers."
Wang's eyes widened. Her mind was being opened up. Almost visibly, Nathan thought.
"But probably nobody's ever going to count them," Wang said.
"Actually, that's my job," said Toby Fox, with a touch of pride.
"Hey, there she is. Katie, Katie Burgreen."
A woman, strawberry blonde, aged maybe 30, was crossing the road with a determined stride. She glanced over in surprise at Bill Lovell, and with evident caution at Nathan and his buddies in their bristling combat gear.
"What's this? An invasion?"
Lovell shrugged.
"I think they're here to count us, or something. Right now these guys have lost their way. You think your father could give the U.S. Navy some water?"
She grinned almost cheekily.
"Well, they could ask."
"This way," she said to Nathan. that you'll need to leave your weapons at the door.
Chapter 19. Jack Green, aged about 60, was a bookish, firebrand kind of a guy, it seemed to Nathan Boss. He stared down Lieutenant Allen on his doorstep, actually stared down this huge armed marine, before allowing him and his troopers into his house. Even then, they did indeed have to leave their weapons at the door, and take their combat boots off at the porch. So they were all in their socks when they walked into the house's big living room, with its unlit hearth and a few hunting trophies, and heaps of books and papers. It was very neat, Nathan thought, almost military neat. He already knew this man had a daughter, the woman called Katie. Nathan immediately guessed this was the home of a widower, with too much time on his hands. Jack Green glared at them all, as though they were naughty children.
"Okay, I'll let you in, out of the heat. Common humanity demands that. I'll give you water. There's a pump out back."
With a nod, Allen deputized a couple of the guys to go fetch a few jugs. They dumped their kit by the door and moved. Soon the guys were all drinking from pottery mugs.
"Glugging it faster than Boston natives on St. Patrick's Day," observed Wang.
Jack faced Lieutenant Allen.
"I can loan you a stepper. Then you can send one of these warrior children of yours to track down your airships, can't you?"
He laughed.
"What a comical mess. Thank you, sir." "Don't thank me, 'cause it's all I'm going to do for you."
He waved a hand.
"Oh, you may as well sit. Just don't break anything, or play with anything, or mess up my papers."
The Marines began to dump more kit, unhook their body armor, take off their camouflage jackets. They sat in little huddles, talking quietly, and Nathan saw that within minutes, one of them had his travel scrabble set out, and had started a three-hand game with a couple of the guys. Allen looked on with disgust.
"You don't bring your stepper, McKibben. You don't bring any goddamn drinking water. But you bring your scrabble? Got to get your priorities right, Lieutenant."
Jack sat down at his paper-laden desk. All the furniture looked handmade, Nathan saw. Kind of rough, but sturdy. Jack said,
"Well, I can't say I'm surprised to see you. The news of your triumphant progress across the world precedes you. But Bill, why the hell did you bring these people to me?"
The former postman looked mischievous.
"Why, who better in our little community to welcome our, liberators?"
That little exchange put Lieutenant Allen on alert. Without being asked, he sat opposite Jack and pulled a printed list of names out of his jacket pocket.
"John Rodney Green, called Jack. That's you, right? What have you got there, your Christmas card list?" "A list of signatories of your so-called Valhalla Declaration of Independence, sir, and their advisers."
Jack just grinned.
"So what are you going to do now? Shoot me? Arrest me and bundle me aboard your airship?" "We're here to protect you, sir, not to create trouble." "Thanks. In fact, we're grateful to you for your assistance so far, Mr. Green," Allen said precisely. "And you can help us out further. Now Ensign Fox here," he snapped his fingers to summon Fox, "is working on a census."
"Is he? Good for you, sonny."
"Now we're here, I can see it's going to take some time. What with you having this mishmash you call a county spread over several worlds and so on. So, if you have a spare room where Fox can bunk down..."
"I'm not having datum troops under my roof."
"We're prepared to compensate you."
Jack looked amused.
"With what?"
"Well, monetarily, obviously. I'm authorized to sign checks up to a limit. We carry cash."
"What cash? Dollars, right?"
Allen said sternly,
"The legal tender of this community, being in the U.S. Aegis as it is, sir."
Jack sighed.
"But what am I gonna do with dollars? You imagine I can pay Bill here in dollars for a catch of fish? What the hell is he gonna do with them? You'd end up with bits of paper circling around and around this community like flies over a cowpat."
Allen was going to snap back some angry response, but Fox leaned forward, interested.
"Then How would you want paying, sir? How does that work around here?
We call it favors, Jack said.
Favors?
I give you a room for a few nights. That's a favor. Now you owe me a favor. We agree what that is before you move in, right? If it was Bill, it would be so many pounds of fish. He does the favor for me, and we're square. Or if I don't need any fish, then Bill can go to old Mike Doak down the street, who can shoe horses like he was raised to it, and give him the fish, thus transferring the favor he owes me to Mike. And then when my horse throws a shoe... I get it.
Alan raised his hands.
Fox said, So you don't use paper money, but you must get outside workers coming through, doctors, dentists...
We support them with favors, one way or another.
Specialists, like engineers to build your dam, something like that. There must be occasions when there's nothing you can do for someone like that. You can only eat one meal at a time, wear one pair of trousers.
Jack winked at Fox.
Good question. Okay, we do have stashes. Gold, silver, jewelry, even a little paper money, if you must know. We accept all this if there's no other way for a person to pay who's desperate enough. We're not monks here, enslaved to a rule book. We cheat a little. Whatever works. But basically, we're self-sufficient locally. Almost all of it is favors.
Alan eyed him.
So you do take dollars. But you won't take dollars from us. From members of the U.S. Armed Forces.
Jack laughed in his face.
Listen, you and your paymasters in Washington forfeited any right to help from me and my community when you cut us off a dozen years ago, when you trashed pioneer support and impounded my life savings. You even fired poor old Bill here.
Lovell grinned.
Don't bring me into it. I'm doing fine. And none of the Aegis rights and responsibilities crap spouted by President Cowley cuts any ice with me,
Jack said.
Yes, Lieutenant. I'll give you water to relieve the discomfort of these children you're leading astray. Other than that, I could take your dollars, but I won't. Because I don't like you, or the Dayton government you represent, and I want to see the back of you.
Nathan could see Lieutenant Allen's temperature rising like a volcano on slow heat.
This is all bullshit.
Fox said earnestly, With respect, sir, it's not. This kind of meeting of minds is precisely why...
Shut your cake hole, sailor.
Yes, sir.
Fox shrank back immediately. Alan produced a fold of currency from an inside pocket, $100 bills. He set this on Jack's homemade desk.
I'm asking you to take this, sir, or face the consequences.
Jack, totally at ease, just faced him.
What is it that poor troll said when the likes of you tried to take her cub away? That was nothing to do with the U.S. military. I will not.
He repeated the phrase, backing it up with the troll's sign language.
I will not, sir. I will not.
Alan glowered.
Ensign Fox. Cuff this man.
Jack just laughed. Fox sat frozen, indecisive. There was a flurry in the corner where the guys were playing Scrabble.
Kevin, you butthole, there is no way under the sun that duct tape is a single word.
I don't think cuffing is an appropriate response, Lieutenant Allen,
Nathan said calmly. Allen stalked out of the house, furious. Nathan wondered how the hell he was going to explain all this to Captain Kaufman. When he did try, the first thing she did was to put Lieutenant Sam Allen off her ship, the first opportunity she got. The second thing she did was to ask to meet this character Jack Green, so she could learn all about this business of the favors for herself. Chapter 20. In the mine belt, the Valientes aboard Gold Dust witnessed a crisis. The airship fleet had stopped a couple of times over the arid worlds of this band,
to take on board ore of various kinds, not just bulky stuff like bauxite, or even obviously precious metals like silver and gold, but a slew of minerals that were scarce now on the datum, or at any rate hugely valuable. Germanium, cobalt, gallium. But it wasn't a colonized world where the incident happened. The family happened to be making one of their visits to the wheelhouse at the time, and Helen and Dan saw it all. The train had slowed because they were approaching a notorious joker, some 80,000 steps from the datum, and the pilot knew to take care, driving them forward at only a couple of steps a minute. When they finally stepped into the joker, the landscape of the neighbouring world, a sparse green with forest clumps and prairie, vanished to reveal bare, brick-red, dust-strewn rock. Even the local Mississippi was reduced to a rusty trickle, striped down the centre of a valley that looked much too wide for it.